From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tattoos rule right now, but rings have ruled and made mischief for a long, long time. Historian Wendy Doniger looks in particular at the role of rings in life and myth and story in the realm of love, sex, fidelity, and betrayal from ancient India to Shakespeare to Beyoncé. This hour On Point, the power of the ring. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do rings still resonate with you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Chicago is Wendy Doniger, professor of the history of religions at the University of Chicago. She's author of over 40 books, including Redeeming the Kama Sutra, The Implied Spider, The Bed Trick. Her latest is titled The Ring of Truth and Other Myths of Sex and Jewelry. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Wendy, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, let's say right off the bat, this is about, yeah, men and women in rings, but this is nothing like a De Beers ad. We're not promoting diamond rings or anything of the sort here. We're looking at what you are in this book, the history, the mythology that leaves rings so wound up in the middle of romantic relations over thousands of years.
Thousands of years, thousands of miles. Yes. We actually do end up with the De Beers ad talking about how it came about and how it mythologized the purchase of rings and rode piggyback on thousands of years of stories to persuade people that if you didn't have a diamond engagement ring, the guy didn't really love you. And if you did, he really did love you, which is the mythology of the ring.
Rings have this really interesting symbolic power. In this case, your investigation, you say there's a kind of ring and story that this book is not about. You say it's not about the Scandinavian lore of the ring of power, the ring that allows the wearer to rule the world or become master of time and space, the evil ring the bad guys want to possess, the ring that eventually falls into the hands of Frodo. That's not this. You say this is a book about the interactions of men with women around rings.
That's right. There's power there too, of course, but it's a different kind of power.
Yes. So begin to take us in there. I mean, you look all over the world. You've got a lot of background, particularly in South Asia and Hindu mythology. But here you're looking over a very wide swath of story and myth around the ring. Why do you think humans have been so drawn to this notion of this circle of metal or maybe with a stone attached as representing all kinds of power? Never mind Frodo and Lord of the Rings here.
I think partly because you wear it on your hand, it's the predecessor to fingerprints. So the earliest rings, signet rings, for instance, were unique. And anyone who had that ring could prove that he was you or you were him or whatever it was. So that to give someone a ring in that world meant to give yourself, to pledge yourself to someone. Rings are really closer parts of the body than other parts of jewelry. Women at night, you take off your necklaces, you take off your earrings, but you usually leave your ring on. And after some years, you can't even take a ring off. A finger swell if you get old enough. So that the ring is part of the body in a way, and the symbolism of putting the finger through the ring is a symbolism of the sexual act. So as you put the ring on the bride's finger, you're symbolizing your right to do that to her too. So rings as symbols of sexual love grow out of the basic symbolism of identity. I give myself to you, and also now you are mine. I mark you with my ring, my signet ring. I imprint you as my property.
Do you think rings have the same symbolic power today? I mean, look around at this latest generation of millennials, and you see just an incredible landscape of tattoos. But I'm looking at headlines here about jewelry and rings, and Americans are just buying less of it. Has the sort of center of gravity shifted here from that band on the finger to the ink on the arm or the shoulder or you name it?
I think so in some ways. I think also the symbolism of rings, the idea, one of the ideas that I found connected to jewelry all through the Indo-European world at least, mm-hmm. is that when a woman gets an expensive piece of jewelry, everybody assumes she got it by sleeping with some man. That's what I call the slut assumption. So if she's married, her husband gave it to her. And if she's married and her husband didn't give it to her, Eyebrows are raised. The assumption is she must have gotten it by sleeping with somebody else. And that's built into the mythology right from the Hebrew Bible through Shakespeare through Hollywood. And what's changed now is that some women would prefer to buy their own jewelry, thank you. And therefore, a woman could now appear in public with a new piece of jewelry and you would no longer assume that she necessarily got it from a man. And that's a big change.
Well, for many and for a long time, you remind us, a ring, particularly if it was a valuable ring, it was one of the relatively few items that a woman could own and possess.
It was her property. It was the only property she had. If she decided to leave her husband, she couldn't take anything else with her. She could take that. It was her independence in a way. It was insurance. And I think that's one of the reasons why stories about women and their rings, which are mostly written by men, most of the literature we have from the ancient and medieval world is after preserved at least by men, is about the conniving of women, the trickery of women, how they sneak their rings, how they use their rings to prove the paternity of their children and so forth. So because that's all women really had. And in some societies today, the whole family's wealth is in the woman's jewelry. In Tibet, a woman wears all the gold that the family has. She's the bank. She's the family's bank. And she sleeps at night next to a very large Tibetan mastiff that protects the investment. So it's not just jewelry that women wear against men. They sometimes wear jewelry for men and for their children, too.
You share many, many stories from myth and history and literature in this book, The Ring of Truth. You start right off talking about your first chapter, Marriage Rings and Adultery Rings. Take us into stories that represent what you're conveying from that angle.
Well, I think you can divide the mythology of rings into two types, which I typified by the two icons of my youth, Doris Day and Marilyn Monroe. So the Doris Day ring is the don't sleep with him until you get the ring on your finger. That's the marriage ring. And that was the symbol of the woman's virginity as well, too. That's what she gave to her husband in exchange for the ring. The Marilyn Monroe ring is the get as much jewelry from him as you can before and after you marry him. And it was an anti-marriage ring in a way. The independent woman, the courtesan who amassed jewelry, and the amount of jewelry she had was proof of how beautiful and seductive she was. So in our day, you get Elizabeth Taylor, whose famous jewelry was proof that she was, in fact, the most beautiful woman in the world. That's the way the myth worked. So the adultery rings are also the rings that women get outside of their marriage, which are proof that they have, in fact, been unfaithful. That's the ring where the woman often argues that it's fake jewelry. Where'd you get that new diamond necklace? Oh, those aren't real diamonds. I just picked that up in Woolworths.
Any old thing.
Because if they are any old thing, exactly, this old thing. Mm-hmm. Because if they are real diamonds, then she has committed adultery. So that's the way the proofs have worked so often in mythology. There's a Nora Ephron story in her semi-autobiographical story about how she divorced Ted Bernstein, where she goes to the family jeweler to get a ring repaired. And while the jeweler was repairing it, he chats with her and he says, "And how did you like the bracelet?" And she says,
"What?
The bracelet?" And the jeweler, realizing he's made a serious error, says, no, I'm sorry, I got mixed up. But in fact, that was how she had proof that her husband had, in fact, committed adultery, which she had reason to suspect for other reasons.
Because he was buying jewelry for some other woman in this case.
For some other woman whom he must have been sleeping with. I mean, it's not logical. There are lots of reasons to buy jewelry and give jewelry. But the myth, which is very powerful, that's what myth is. It's a story that persuades you against logic. The myth is, well, she must have been sleeping, or as this case may be, he must have been sleeping with some because he bought a bracelet.
I mean, there were talking about Nora Ephron and Carl Bernstein from our immediate backyard in terms of the sweep of time. But these stories, it's amazing how persistent they are over vast amounts of time. You can go way back, and there are human stories with exactly these dynamics.
Yes. And even more complicated plots, totally illogical plots, where the ring is taken as proof when it, in fact, is not proof, starting with the Hebrew Bible, the story of Tamar and Judah, where she disguises herself and sleeps with him and won't sleep with him till he gives her his ring, and he does. Later on, she comes back pregnant, and he says, well, you whore, we're going to have you killed. She produces the ring, and she says, the man that made me pregnant is the man who owns this ring. And Judah throws up his hands and says, she's more righteous than I am. He takes it as proof that he is, in fact, the father of the child. But of course it isn't. She could have stolen the ring, gotten it from some other woman he'd slept with and so forth. And at points in the history of this story, people do say that's not my ring or you could have stolen that ring. So they knew about the logic just as well as we did. They weren't stupid. But the power of the story was more powerful than logic. And so the man always says, wow, at the end of All's Well That Ends Well, he says, well, that's my ring. That's it. It's proof that I slept with you after all. That's my child, therefore. Therefore, the child you are carrying is my child, which is also the point of the story. It's proof where it isn't proof.
But the form of proof, I guess before biometrics and before fingerprints, people were looking for something. A ring was about as intimate as they could get.
That's right. That's right. The ring was unique. It's a seal. And the metaphor, Aristotle has the metaphor that the man stamps his image on the embryo in the woman's womb. So the man is imprinting himself on the son. The fact that the son looks just like his dad, chip off the old block, is part of the same mythology.
Wendy Doniger is a professor of the history of religions at the University of Chicago and author of the new book, The Ring of Truth and Other Myths of Sex and Jewelry. We're talking about the human fascination with rings, the rings on our fingers and other baubles and bangles as well, and the role they play in myths and stories of love, loss, mystery, betrayal, fidelity. Do you feel the power of a ring to signify, enchant, commit, remind, seduce? Elvis takes us out. She wears my ring. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. She swears to wear it with eternal devotion. That's why I say, because she wears my ring. That's why I say, because she wears my ring. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the human fascination across great expanses of time with rings. Rings, men, women, power, fidelity, betrayal, marriage, adultery? Wendy Doniger is with us. She's written a new book, The Ring of Truth and Other Myths of Sex and Jewelry. You can join us in this hour. Do you feel the power of a ring to signify, enchant, commit? What is it about a ring or some other bit of jewelry, gold or silver, shiny stone that can seem to carry magic or make us do crazy things? Do rings and jewelry still have that magic? Or today, is it all in your tats, your tattoos? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Wendy Doniger joins us from Chicago. She's a professor of the history of religions at the University of Chicago. Wendy, it's interesting. We've got people responding online. Ari says, today, jewelry is the lazy husband's gift, sort of the passé way of looking at it, but there can still be drama. Mari writes to us. She makes original craft jewelry, she says. She says, only one diamond engagement ring during my life, I guess, that she had, and she writes, and it was stolen back by the ex who gave it to me. So who needs that pseudo-sentimental Indian-giving BS? She says, make your own adornments, ladies. And Ellen writes to us, by the way, wearing a ring can serve to ward off unwanted sexual advances. Male and female rings, it doesn't have to be real, just real enough to signal I'm not looking to be taken. Many, many ways of using the power and the symbolism, Wendy.
Yes, there are indeed. A Catholic priest of my acquaintance once told me that when he and his fellow priests would go out in the evening in mufti and didn't want to have to deal with women, they wore wedding rings. It was a common practice to ward off, just like the woman who wrote to you. So rings have a lot of ways of giving signals. Men, of course, also take off their wedding rings when they go out looking for other women. So it's still a widely accepted symbol, even though, of course, not everyone has a wedding ring, certainly not everyone has an engagement ring. So it's not a universal symbol, but it's still widely used to give signals of all sorts.
Rings have wild lives sometimes in a lot of ancient mythology, and there's this whole trope of the ring fished from the ocean. What's that about? And give us some examples. Rings and fish come into play.
You'd be surprised how many stories there are, including recent Hollywood movies, about Big Fish was a wonderful example, about the story of a ring swallowed by a fish. And now apparently it is true that some fish do in fact swallow rings, and you're not supposed to wear jewelry when you swim in shark-infested waters. I suppose you're not supposed to swim in them in the first place, but if you do, you aren't supposed to wear jewelry. But the story of the ring and the fish, again, it's one of these illogical stories which has some kind of a pull on the human imagination. It seems to symbolize the unlikelihood of extraordinary good luck, that you throw the ring into the water and you make a vow, I will do this or that because the ring will never come back, and the ring does come back. So the ring comes back in the fish when you thought it was lost forever. And there are stories of children lost in rings, and both the child and the ring is in the fish. Many stories across Europe, a lot of Christian mythology of the ring and the fish. There's the city of Glasgow. The flag, the symbol of the city, is a salmon with a ring in its mouth. And that comes from the story of the founding of Glasgow by the Bishop of Glasgow and so forth and so on, where a woman who had been a queen had given a ring that she had been given by her husband. She gave it to her lover, and the king demanded to have it back, and the lover had lost it, and he was about to kill her, burn her as an adulteress, when the Bishop of Glasgow came to the rescue, found a salmon with the ring in it, gave it back to the queen. The queen said, "The king, you see, I've been fine all along." The king forgave her, and she immediately went into seclusion and became a nun to the rest of her life. So that's the story of the founding of the city of Glasgow. It's a crazy story, but you find it in important places in what comes to really political history. In Venice, the Doge would throw a ring into the river to symbolize the relationship, the marriage of the king of Venice, the Doge of Venice, the marriage to the waters around it. And that ring came back once, and they knew that basically Venice had divorced that Doge. Stories all over of rings and fish, of the unlikeliness of the past coming back, things you think you've lost forever and they come back after all. Lots of stories symbolizing what Freud would call the return of the repressed, the things that we forget, and the ring reminds us of them. That's the ring and the fish story.
And right up to date in Big Fish, as you remind us, in 2003, the movie there with Ewan McGregor and Albert Finney, they play Edward Bloom during different times in his life. And here's a little bit from the opening scene. Edward is telling the story of the day his son, Will, was born. Once he's telling it to a Boy Scout troop and the other to Will's prom date, claiming that he caught an enormous catfish using his wedding ring as bait.
"Now, I tied my ring onto the strongest line they made. Strong enough to hold up a bridge, they said, if only for a few minutes. And then I cast upriver.
The beast jumped up and grabbed it before he even hit the water. And just as fast, he snapped clean through that line. Well, you can see my predicament. My wedding ring, the symbol of fidelity to my wife, soon to be mother of my child, was now lost in the gut of an uncatchable fish.
My wedding ring, symbol of fidelity, lost in the gut of an uncatchable fish. Okay, they're making the link once again there, but take us through it. What's the link between all this wild adventures with rings and fish in the sea and love and commitment and men and women, Wendy?
Well, if the last line in that wonderful excerpt, I'm so glad you put it on, was the son saying, "Make him stop. He's tired of hearing this story.
I can't hear this one more time."
That's right. I can't stand it. It's a fish story, right? It's like the fisherman's lie about the fish he caught. And at the end of the movie, the story comes true and the boy realizes that it was true all along. So just as the unlikelihood of the fish bringing back the ring that you'd lost, it's the unlikelihood that you can ever really lose the love you have for the woman of your life. It's the romantic myth. No matter how you try to get away from her, somehow or other in the end, she is your own true love. And the ring symbolizes that kind of lasting the eternity of a circle that never ends and so forth. The old Ring song, I gave my love a circle that has no end, a ring that has no end. So it symbolizes something that you can't get rid of. And love, true love, is supposed to be like that. That's the story of the ring. No matter what you do, it symbolizes fidelity to my wife, says the man, who has been unfaithful to her many, many times. Nevertheless, in the end, it's true love, and in the end, the ring comes back. So that's its symbolism.
Wendy Doniger writes, by overcoming reason, the myths around rings allow us to believe what we want to believe about the power and endurance of sexual love and about our ability to rebalance the moral world. Wendy Doniger's new book is The Ring of Truth. Call is for you, Wendy. Alexandra in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Alexandra, you're on with Wendy Doniger in Chicago. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I kind of had a question about maybe you could go more in depth into the background and the history of like the promise ring. I know it's kind of used more today with young adults, and it seems kind of like the replacement of the high school ring whenever you are in love like that. Does it change the relationship after that? Do you see anything interesting with it?
The promise ring, or as you say, the class ring, there's a wonderful film where one man is telling another man, he shows him his class ring with the signia on the top. And he says, and look, he says, you turn it around and it's a marriage ring when you switch it so that the emblem is on the bottom of your hand. So in a way, it is half of a marriage ring. It's a foretaste of a marriage ring. It is a promise. The engagement ring also serves that. It's not the same as a marriage ring. The marriage ring is traditionally the marriage ring is plain. It's plain gold. Nowadays, sometimes you can get a fancier marriage ring. Mm-hmm. But the plainness of the ring, the simplicity of the ring is supposed to be what the marriage is. And the flash and glamour of the engagement ring is what I think you think marriage is going to be before you get married. So the promise ring is one step earlier than that, too. It acknowledges that high school or even college romance may not be the real thing, but it's as real as you've got at that age. And I think it is an appropriate first step in a kind of a series. Nowadays, jewelers will give you divorce rings, anniversary rings, apology rings. The guy's caught with another woman. He gives his wife yet another ring and so forth. Rings go and perform all sorts of services in the relationships of men and women. And it's interesting that I think significant that the marriage ring is indeed the simple one. All the other rings are full of perhaps unkeepable promises, but the marriage ring is plain.
And maybe keepable, one hopes. Jessica in Salem, Massachusetts. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I had a question for Wendy, and I was going to tell a quick story about my husband and I. We actually got my engagement ring together. We picked it out together after we were married. Okay. And the wedding bands we picked out together as well. Mm-hmm. Those were really, really important to us, the bands. And, people around us thought that it was really kind of odd that we did that. But I'm proud of it because it meant more. And it meant more to him and to me.
You mean doing it after you were married, choosing them after?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, we chose the engagement ring together.
Yeah.
After we were married, about I guess it was a month or two, we waited a little while, and I showed up at work and I had this diamond ring all of a sudden, and I know that there were a couple of people that thought it was really odd, but I didn't care. I thought it was more meaningful. I really did. We picked out the wedding bands far earlier. Those were really kind of a big deal. But we were excited about those.
So you made your own way with the tradition, and why not? I mean, after all, it's your relationship. But what's your question for Wendy, Jessica?
Well, I wanted to know when the men started to wear the wedding band and what was the significance? Because I know that it's fairly recent compared to the woman's ring. And so I was just really curious about that.
It's a good question. You're absolutely right that the original band was given to the woman, and the statement with this ring I thee wed, and with all my worldly goods I thee endow, was taken really to mean that with the ring, the husband endowed the wife with a key to unlock all the things that he owns. It was like she became the caretaker of his estate. And so it was very much a one-way thing. The exchange of rings comes much later, I think as late as the 19th century in England, in Europe in general. The double ring wedding is a much later thing. And of course, men never did get engagement rings. So that remains a one-way street for most people. Traditionally, it's only the woman who gets the engagement ring. So the single ring ceremony that originally was the one ring ceremony where the man gave the woman a wedding ring remains in the single ring tradition of the engagement ring. But the double wedding came at a time when romance was more mutual, I would say. In the old medieval stories of Tristan and Isolde and Lancelot and Guinevere and so forth, there's a very important ring, but it's a single ring. And then in later tellings of the story, they exchange rings. So it begins to come up, I think, in the medieval romances that she gives him a ring and he gives, as well as the fact that he gives her a ring. It becomes part of romance, really, as opposed to simply wedding.
Is there something about a shift in the power relationship between genders that's represented in that as well, or in expectations, Wendy?
I think so. I think certainly there's an equality. In those stories, for instance, the ones I mentioned, the woman is the queen. She is more powerful than the man. He is her lover, and she is the one who has the royal power, Guinevere, of course, and also Isolde, who's married to King Mark. So I think that is part of the medieval romantic tradition, which is also very much of a Christian tradition of romance. And it goes right from Ireland right across to Germany and England and France.
You write about rings of forgetfulness in medieval romances. What does that mean?
Ah, the ring of forgetfulness. That's a wonderful story. So rings normally are for memory. They remind you of the person who gave the ring to you. And there are stories of people who give a ring to someone, and when they lose the ring, they magically forget the person who had given them the ring. And those stories are introduced into medieval stories and also German and Indian stories to save the man from a kind of caddishness, so that in the older versions of those stories, there often is no ring. He seduces the woman, sometimes marries her, usually does not, and goes off and then marries another woman or seduces another woman. And later on, this is what happens in the earlier versions of Siegfried and Brunhilde, for instance. He meets Brunhilde, they sleep together, and he goes off and finds a girl with more money and marries her. Well, when Siegfried then becomes a great German hero, and the same thing happens in India, where the king who seduced the girl becomes a great dynastic hero, the story is retold. And in order to save the reputation of the caddish hero, they say, well, you know, there was a ring he gave her, and when she lost the ring, it was magic. When he lost the ring, it was magic, and he couldn't remember her. And only when the ring came back, and you will be surprised to hear it came back in a fish that was fished out of the water.
Of course.
Only when the ring came back, the king said, oh, yeah, I did marry that girl. Damn it, sure I did. And they lived happily ever after. So the ring patches up some stories. It was such a well-known cliche of folklore that in retelling a story, a bard who wanted to rehabilitate his hero could simply throw in a magic ring of forgetfulness or memory. And he saved the reputation of the cad.
The investment of meaning in that little band can be so deep. It's kind of scary if it's lost or if it comes back, whatever it does, a kind of throw weight there. Wendy Doniger's new book is The Ring of Truth and Other Myths of Sex and Jewelry. You can join us this hour. Have you felt the power of a ring, a wedding band, an heirloom, something more exotic? Does all this seem like something from long ago, Middle Ages, or Frank Sinatra time behind us right here? I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking rings. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
She'll glitter and gleam so, make somebody dream so, that someday Someday I may buy her a ring, ring-a-ling-a. I have heard that's where it leads, wearing baubles, bangles, and beads. All those noisy bangles.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onpoint. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the human fascination with rings, the rings on our fingers and other bangles and baubles, and the role they play in myths and stories of love and loss and mystery, betrayal, fidelity, and the opposite. Wendy Doniger is with us. She's professor of the history of religions at the University of Chicago. Her new book is The Ring of Truth and Other Myths of Sex and Jewelry. Myth is deeply referenced here. All kinds of myths and stories about rings over the years, and it comes right up into Hollywood time and the stories we've heard much more recently. I mean, here's more than half a century ago, but 1953, the film Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. Marilyn Monroe, who Wendy mentioned earlier, plays Lorelei Lee, an American showgirl with a passion for diamonds and a belief that attracting a rich husband is how a woman can succeed economically. Here's the scene where her fiancé, Gus, played by Tommy Noonan, presents her with a diamond ring.
Mr. Esmond!
Is it the right size?
Oh, they can never be too big. Do you think it's too small, Dorothy?
Looks like it ought to have a highball around it.
I mean, does it fit your finger?
Oh, yes, it fits perfect. Daddy, I bet you made me the happiest girl in the world.
Wendy Doniger in Chicago. She, Gus says, is it the right size? And she's thinking carrots. He's thinking the size of her finger.
That's
right. Oh, my gosh.
And that, of course, has that wonderful song, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, which became a motto of many people. But the size of the ring, so basically, Marilyn, based on the novel by Anita Loos, plays a gold digger. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole series of stories about women like that who wanted to get as large a diamond ring as they could. There's the joke about the beautiful blonde who's married an old, rich old man, and he died, and she said he was wonderful. And in his will, all he asked was that I spend $1 million on a memorial stone. And she held out her hand and said, and here it is. So that's the gold digger with her $1 million stone. And that's a real figure in American legal history as well. There was anti-gold digger legislation in the early 20th century where there was a real fear that these women were going to be hoodwinking old, gullible old men.
They were really freaked out. Legislation, no less.
Yep. They got really worried about it. The question of whether the woman could keep her jewelry after a broken engagement was what the legislation was all about. And in the earlier period where women were regarded as frail and men were just making them promises to get only one thing from them and so forth, the legislation protected women when men broke their engagements. And the later anti-gold digger legislation protected men when women led them up the garden path.
You take us through many continents of story here. I mean, one of your chapters is headlined Pregnant Riddles and Clever Wives. You gave us a taste of that before, but what's the genre of ring story, jewelry story that you're taking us to there?
Pregnancy is the riddle there. It's amazing how widespread this story is. A man is forced to marry a woman he doesn't really love and refuses to sleep with her, locks her up sometimes, goes away and says, I will not sleep with you until you produce a son that I've fathered.
Wait, I won't sleep with you, but you have to produce a son that I fathered. So she
can't win. That's the riddle.
Okay.
That's the riddle. You'd think she couldn't win. You'd think that this was such a silly story that no one else would ever tell it. It's all over the Indo-European world. It's in Shakespeare's All's Well That Ends Well. So the way she does it is by disguising herself as another lower class woman, usually, or foreign woman, someone who doesn't have the dignity and class status that has put him off her in the first place. She sort of whores it up in some way, and in disguise, he doesn't recognize her. Sometimes she simply just puts on a sexier dress, and he doesn't recognize her, and he really wants to go to bed with her, and she won't do it until he gives her his signet ring, the ring that proves who he is. He does so. She becomes pregnant and comes back home. And he goes home later on and sees her and says, I couldn't have fathered that child because I've never slept with you. And he's about to divorce her or kill her when she produces the ring. And she says, you gave me this ring the night we slept together. And he says, by God, this is my child. You are my wife. And everything is just fine.
Pretty dim, and these that, guys. Okay.
So what it means really is, I think, that he really does want a child. He wants a legal heir. After all, she's the only one the other women he's sleeping with when he's out of town are not going to give him a legal heir. He wants that. So part of him wants to believe that this is his child and that he can sleep with his wife after all. And the ring is an excuse. And that story is told in the Arabic world, in the Semitic world. It's in Boccaccio. It's in ancient India. It's an amazing, the riddle of get a child. It's there in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, where in the Elizabeth Taylor, Paul Newman scene, where she wants so much to have a baby and Big Daddy wants her to have a baby and so forth, and he won't sleep with her. And he says, how are you going to get a child when you're married to a man who can't stand you? That's the euphemism. Mm-hmm. And she says, that boy of mine is a problem that I will have to solve. And she does it without a ring in the Tennessee Williams play. But it's obviously a real problem of women who have husbands who don't want to sleep with them. And the ring is about that real problem in a very unreal way, in a crazy, fantastic way. The solution is an insane solution, but it's a satisfying one, and people love to tell that crazy story.
The clever wife comes up again. I mean, it gets in rougher territory here. You've got a whole section on the rape of the clever wife. How's the ring come into that
There are several stories in the Greek and Roman tradition, a play by Plautus, based upon a play by the Greek Menander, in which, again, a man marries a wife. He doesn't want to marry her. He has a girlfriend he'd rather marry. His father makes him marry this woman, so he won't sleep with her. He goes away and he comes back, and only a few months later, she gives birth to a child, to a son. So he says, well, indeed, you're a slut. I'll divorce you. And it turns out that several months before he married her, he got drunk one night and raped a woman during a festival, and also, depending on whether you read the Menander or the Plautus version, either gave her a ring or took a ring from her. And she has that ring now. And it proves that he had raped her before he married her, but it was in the dark and he didn't know who she was and she didn't know who he was. And when he's given this news that he was the one who did this, he says, oh, how wonderful, how great, this solves everything. And you think, what kind of a cad is this guy, right?
Yeah.
He not only raped her, but in some versions robbed her. But it means the kid is his kid. And that's all these stories really care about. She wasn't unfaithful to him. It's not that she was raped. It's that she only slept with him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crazy set of values. You have to say that he's a cad. And if everyone in ancient Greece was doing it, then the whole culture is a cad.
So much about identity here and ownership, and the ring is one of the few ways, at least to symbolically suggest, that you have some idea what's actually going on. Craig in Nashville, Tennessee. Craig, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I was just had a thought. Okay, rings in America and, you know, marriage. Okay, back in the 70s, the divorce rate was once in your lifetime, and I think nowadays it's up to four. The average is four in a person's lifetime.
I don't know about that exactly, Craig, but where are you going with that?
Well, no, I mean, I just mean that ring, that must not mean as much as it did, and I'm just wondering, Is it because more women are in the workforce today and they don't have to depend on a man? Because I know back in the day that, you know, most women were stay-at-home mothers. And, you know, so divorce wasn't that big of an issue. And I'm just thinking, is divorce getting just easier since so many people are doing it nowadays?
And the ring, by that light, perhaps just doesn't mean what it once did. How do you respond to that, Wendy? I mean, you know what Craig's talking about, and
the ring doesn't produce true love. The ring is supposed to symbolize true love. You're supposed to have the true love first, and then you get the ring.
Yeah.
Only in the magic fairy tales does the ring magically bewitch the man so that the minute he puts on the ring, he forgets that he's married. There are stories like that, again, in the Lancelot tradition where they put a ring on him and he forgets that he's in love with Guinevere and sleeps with Elaine instead. The ring can't produce a marriage, and the ring, of course, doesn't ever produce fidelity. You don't stay with the guy because he gave you a diamond ring. The ring is supposed to predict fidelity. And the gentleman who called in is perfectly right. It doesn't produce anything at all. And if the desire to stay married is not there, not the biggest diamond ring that Van Cleef & Arpels ever made is going to keep that marriage together.
But in a way, Craig, in a roundabout way, is going at the whole idea of true love, which the ring was supposed to represent. But asking if, you know, is that too just based on what social constructs and dynamics and in different times and places, that whole idea has more or less strength?
The idea of true love is a widespread idea, and there is evidence that it does exist. The idea that it coincides with marriage is the tricky part.
And there's, the ring is supposed to step into the breach.
That's right. The ring is supposed to put those two things together. On the one hand, true love, and on the other hand, marriage. And what we're really talking about is time. We're talking about lasting love. We're talking about love that overcomes all the obstacles and stays around for a long time. And the eternity of that, the constantness of that. The diamond is also, according to the De Beers ad, supposed to symbolize that because it's the hardest substance we know. But, of course, it's very easy to lose a diamond ring.
Yes.
And there goes the fidelity and so forth. Yep. So I think the symbolism is right there, but what it symbolizes is something that very few people believe in anymore.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Wendy in Middletown, Connecticut. Wendy, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Wendy Doniger in Chicago.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in my studio right now designing a wedding band, and I'm here with my friend who's also a jewelry designer, and together we've both been designing for over 40 years. So we're listening to your show, realizing that combined we've designed probably close to 2,000 wedding sets, and I just thought the jeweler's perspective is interesting because
yes,
of everything. Mm-hmm. Everything we create, the most spectacular piece for me personally is to design a one-of-a-kind wedding set for a client. So it draws us in to become part of their sacred day. And it by the time we're done from the first meeting until most of the time, if they're local, we'll be invited to the wedding to take part in that. And if they're not local, if they're overseas, they always end up sending us photos or letters. And there's nothing more thrilling for me now, having been a designer for over 40 years, to see a wedding set that I've made when I was a kid. And it's become such a strong part of this couple's life. They've worn it every day. And at this point, it looks more like them than it does me, which I love. So, I mean, as a jeweler, I just want to say it's an honor and a thrill and the most sacred piece of jewelry that I could ever be part of.
Where does it leave you on the question of true love then, dear jeweler Wendy?
Well, I'm a romantic. I've been with my husband over 40 years. I'm a very strong believer in true love. I'm a believer in love. And I've been blessed. A lot of my couples have stayed married. I think, you know, as a jeweler, when I hear that they're not, it's heartbreaking for me. Because, I mean, my worst story is I had a couple in California who had commissioned a piece. It was they're both horseback riders, and they wanted me to design what looks like the forest floor. So it was four colors of gold, like leaves on the forest floor. This set took almost a year for me to design, and they called me after about 6 months to tell me they were splitting up. Then I was just devastated because I thought, oh, my God, I spent more time creating this set than they did staying married.
Wendy, our time is short right here, and I hate to let it go because the jeweler's perspective is just terrific. And thank you for that last story. That's amazing. More time by the jeweler than by the couple themselves. Wendy Doniger in Chicago, we've just got you for another couple of minutes. You've got conclusions here on money and myth, the triumph of myth over reason. Where do you take the whole story of the ring as you head toward your grand finale?
I think the jeweler story was very beautiful in that regard, that
yes,
she has faith in the power of the ring, and yet she's a realist, and she knows that her married couples do not, in fact, always stay together. So I think that's a wonderful conclusion to our conversation, because the ring is about that faith. People keep hoping that it's going to be okay. And they spend a lot of money on the rings, and they put a lot of energy into designing the rings if they're jewelers, and they choose it. I mean, the couples help it too. That's the myth. The myth is that you will stay in love forever, and that the ring symbolizes that. And if you have the ring, you are more likely to stay in love forever, that there's a power in the ring. And if you believe something enough, you can make it come true. It may be that people who are contemplating divorce or infidelity look down at the ring on their hand and remember how happy they were when they first put it on and say, I think I'll stay with the guy a little longer after all. Myth is very powerful. The things that you believe in that there is no proof of govern a great deal of the decisions we make in our lives. And jewelry is, rings in particular, a part of that mythical force in our heads. All the stories we've heard, my mother had this ring, her mother had the ring before her, the family history, the myths you've read, they make you do things that are irrational, and sometimes they make you happier.
Down through the ages, those stories resonate, and maybe the ring does end up having power through that myth. Wendy Doniger at the University of Chicago is author of the new book, The Ring of Truth and Other Myths of Sex and Jewelry. Wendy, it's great talking with you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Behind us right here, Marilyn Monroe. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Maeve Pajess, Sarah Platt, Allison Poley, Tanya Raleigh, and James Ross. With help from Calvin Henry, Grace Seegers, and Michael DeSocio, and Gretchen Voss, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.